We'll be speaking about mechanisms of asymptotic safety.
Great pleasure to give you a talk on mechanisms of asymptotic safety, and I'd like to first thank the organizers for bringing all the protagonists together on this topic, asymptotic safety, and it's a great honor to give my small contribution to that. So I'd like to describe or discuss various mechanisms that help us to establish systems that could be valid to arbitrarily high momentum scales that provide for a safe route to the ultraviolet. But I fully agree with Sean that this is kind of mathematical or perhaps metaphysical problem. But I'd like to convince you that by having such systems, that'll also tell us something about the infrared. We can really learn something about infrared observables that we wouldn't be able to do otherwise. So I'll use various systems as an example: gravity, Young-Mills theory, fermionic systems, and Yukawa systems. I hope I don't confuse you by switching from system to system, but I'd like to emphasize that there can be common mechanisms behind. So this is work done in collaboration with various authors, and I'd like to, in particular, give credit to Astrid Eichhorn and Michael Scherer, who are both here. It was a very enjoyable collaboration. So let me start with listing a number of problems, challenges that motivate all of us and many others to think about new concepts in quantum field theory and beyond. So here's my personal list: quantization of gravity, but also triviality problems that John was mentioning, hierarchy problems, fine tuning problems, and also the fact that in the standard model of particle physics, we have many, many parameters. There's a lot of parameters that are not explained, but just put in by hand. Just to set the stage, let me discuss these problems in a little bit more detail and also to introduce some notation. Of course, there is the fact that we don't know how to conservatively quantize gravity. This program fails, and that's what brings us together here. Let me come to the triviality problem that, in some respects, similar, and Jean was already mentioning it. It was discovered in quantum electrodynamics, and again, it tells us that perturbation theory predicts its own breakdown. So if you insist on keeping the physical coupling fixed and then sending the cutoff to large values, perturbation theory tells you that the bare coupling has to diverge to the final scale. Again, this could be just a perturbative problem, but a full analysis on the lattice and Swiss Archer flow equation tells you that the basic message remains, namely that there is a maximal scale of ultraviolet extension,
and this you can estimate
by the Grandhoff of singularity at 272. Again, a very metaphysical scale. But you can read this equation also the other way around. You can insist on sending the cutoff to infinity, and then you can only satisfy this equation by sending the coupling, the physical coupling, to zero, and that's the property of triviality. So despite the fact that this number here is very big, the triviality problem in the standard model is by no means academic, because, for instance, if the Higgs particle was found to have a mass of 600 GeV, then the Landau pole in the Pi-4 section is on the order of a 2 GeV, and that's the scale we may have access to in the near future. So we have to face triviality problems. Whereas triviality is a true fundamental problem theory, the hierarchy problem is usually just ugly, but it may just be in that way. So the hierarchy problem, for instance, in the standard model is that we don't know why the underlying scale, say a grand unified scale, and the electroweak scale are so far apart from each other. We have to fine-tune an initial mass parameter of 10 to one part in 10 to 28. That's not impossible, but it looks, as I said, very ugly. So let me rephrase this problem in an RG language in order to quantify the problem. So if we look at the running of the dimensionless mass, made dimensionless by a momentum scale, a ruler, a rod in momentum space, and here for convenience, I also scaled out the Yukawa coupling, the Yukawa theory, then the beta function of this dimensionless mass starts with minus 2 times the coupling, means this is basically a straight line with slope minus 2. And this number here, number 2, this is what I will call a critical exponent in the following, the negative of the the slope of the beta function of a certain critical coupling. That's what I call theta in the following, the critical exponent. And the size of these positive critical exponents, this is a measure for the fine-tuning problem. In the standard model, it's 2 multiplied by the terms of corrections, and that's a big fine-tuning problem. That tells this number 2 tells you that there is a quadratic divergence behind. So you can rephrase the cosmological constant problem here with Gaussian 6-point in a similar language, and you would get a value of 4. And so whenever you have big critical exponents, you usually have fine-tuning problems. And in the standard model, if you want to separate the scale of electrically transmitted breaking or parallel breaking from an underlying ultraviolet scale, which usually you have to fine-tune your initial condition very, very precisely. A problem that is, I think, not as well received as the other problems I was talking about is the abundance of parameters in the standard model. And most of the concepts that are made in order to solve the triviality or the parity problem make the abundance of parameters even worse. If you go to supersymmetric extension, your model typically has more than 100 parameters. You go to a different framework, such as strings, you don't even know what to write here. And another problem, which I will not talk a lot about, but which I'd like to mention, is the fact that the number of space-time dimensions and the critical dimension of RT scaling is identical for standard model-like quantum field theory. So imagine some extraterrestrial aliens living in some fractal dimension would still be able to analyze perturbative Feynman diagrams, then they would still find that V equals 4 would be a very nice dimension to have gauge, matter, and Yukawa in these sectors. And looking around us, we observe that our macroscopic universe is of this dimensionality. And as Jean's and Dusternik, the great book, said, it's simply not known whether this is just a mere coincidence or whether these things are logically connected. So with these great challenges in mind, it's time to open up Stephen Weinberg's lecture notes from 76. Where he says, I know of only one promising approach to this problem. So he was referring to renormalizability, but it may also apply to the other problem. So this is asymptotic safety. And I'd first like to give you my own introduction, a cartoon of what asymptotic safety may be described as. So what is behind is, of course, renormalizability. So why do we need renormalizability? It's not just a mathematical concept. But what is behind is that we want to separate infrared physics, the observables that we measure, from the microscopic underlying details. And that is what is technically phrased as kind of independent. Then we want to have a predictive theory. We want to have physical parameters less than infinity. And these concepts are realized in perturbative renormalization, but they're also realized in asymptotic safety. And just to give you a few cartoons, what asymptotic safety is, so imagine we span the space of all possible theories by all possible operators, by all possible correlation functions compatible with symmetry. Then a point in this theory space is a theory at a certain scale. And this we can parameterize, for instance, by an effective action at that scale. And if we start integrating our fluctuation, this theory will move in that theory space. We get an RG trajectory. And one way to calculate this in the effective average action is the evaporation equation that we saw this morning already. I will not go into details of these equations. It's just good to know that there is a method, and there are other methods to compute the flow in theory space. In order to take the cutoff to infinity limit to separate infrared from ultraviolet scales, what is a sufficient condition is the existence of a fixed point, because then you can go to higher and higher scales, but your coupling, at least the dimensionless couplings, don't change. And of course, sitting on the fixed point is very boring, but the vicinity is very interesting, so you can classify the trajectory circles with the fixed point once you go to the ultraviolet, or the ones that move away from the fixed point. And turns out that the ones that hit the fixed point have these positive spin exponents, and the ones negative spin exponents move away. Now the positive ones are the interesting ones because if you go to the infrared, then your system will move in the surface spanned by all the relevant trajectories. And so the physical systems living in this hypersurface in theory space, these are the theories that we can observe in infrared. So it's very important to have a finite number of positive exponents in order to have a finite number of physical parameters and therefore a physical theory. And in fact, if you are worried that unnaturally you would have to set many couplings to certain values to start at the fixed point, even if you are away from the fixed point, but some attractive domain, then the infrared theory, the observables that you measure, will still be the same because all the irrelevant directions die out, and that's exactly what Law described in his talk. So you have technically lambda independence, separated infrared from ultraviolet details. You have hopefully finitely many parameters, and your system is predictive and universal. Just to add a little bit of notation, it's very good to analyze flow equations can be very good, very complicated to beta functions, but it's often sufficient to look at them in the vicinity of the fixed point just to learn how many relevant and irrelevant directions you have by analyzing the eigenvalues of the dystopian of the linearized flow equation, which I call theta. So I'd like to describe to you three different mechanisms of that, two and a half. And the first one I'd like to call dimensional balancing, and that's the one that is, well, that's called the usual one and has been described before. So what do I mean by dimensional balancing? Assume that you have a theory with an important or decisive interaction parameterized by coupling G bar, and in some space-time dimension, usually it's a canonical dimension or delta. Delta, of course, depends on the dimension. In the critical RG dimension, this delta, this is an important coupling, is zero. There you can do nicely perturbation theory, and you usually find the lowest order beta function, which goes like coupling squared. So the coefficient, D naught, with the one loop coefficient, and if this D naught is smaller than zero, the theory is asymptotically free and it's safe. So that's the case in CCD. Now, if you go away from this critical dimension, and if you assume that beta function is somehow analytic in D, then the result you will find for the beta function is, again, this dimensional coefficient that will depend on D, coupling squared, and then you have to make up for the dimensions of the coupling, that, so the coupling will no longer be dimensionless, but you get a D squared K to the power of canonical dimension. Now, if you study the dimensionless flow, the flow of the dimensionless coupling, so you measure your coupling with your rod, which is local in momentum space, a local ruler, then the flow of the dimensionless coupling gets a contribution from dimensional rescaling, so that this tells you how your coupling changes if you measure it with a different ruler, plus fluctuation contribution. And now it's clear that since there are two terms, dimensional one, fluctuation-induced one, these can balance and lead to a fixed point, a zero of the beta function. And that's particularly the case with these two terms of opposite sign. And if you, for physics reasons, want to have a positive coupling, then you have to have a specific sign. So you need a negative fluctuation contribution, like in CCD, and positive contributions with the dimensional rescaling, and then you get these like non-Gaussian fixed points that help you to establish asymptotic spaces. So that's a very generic mechanism that certainly works in many systems. You go slightly away from the critical dimension. That's exactly what Jean told and was able to prove, for instance, for the nonlinear signal model in dimensions larger than 2. So let me mention gravity as an example, and a very simple argument, classical Einstein fluid action, study the running of it. So unit subject cosmology is constant to zero, and in some RT scale, RT scheme defines positive dimensional T scale and a negative fluctuation contribution given to the fixed point. And of course, this has been picked up by Martin in 96 with full functional RT flow. Many people have worked on this, and we know now a lot. There is a lot of improvement in studying the fixed point, the scenic plot of the fixed point in the Newton coupling of not the constant plane. And all these tests tell us that the fixed point seems to be very robust against increasing the truncation, against varying the regulators, and so on and so on. And the basic message is there are so far three different positive stability components, so the number of physical parameters is 3. And, well, they're not very small, so there is this issue of fine-tuning certainly here, but as long as we have a fundamental theory of gravity, we can live with fine-tuning. So let me, for the next 5 minutes, describe our own modest contribution to this, and then return to the mechanism of asymptotic safety. So when we entered the field, I was at the same time enthusiastic as well as very skeptical. And so I wanted to probe the scenario. And I thought, so what about ghosts? In this case, I mean party on top of ghosts. When you do the calculation, you have to gauge fixed fluctuations. And if you think in terms of a functional integral formulation, then you have to insert a gauge fixed in functional and you get the Jacobian of the measure body on top of determinant. And at a first glance, this seems like a technical complication. But in fact, from Galileo's theory, we know that in certain cases, the contributions arising from the ghost can actually be very important. And so here is an example for the background field gauge fixing that is mostly used on the corresponding study of Papadopoulos. Now, from gauge theory, from Young-Mills theory, we know that with gauge fixing, there is a fundamental problem connected, which is the Grieboff problem. But the Grieboff problem tells you that if you choose a smooth gauge fixing, slice out a hypersurface in the configuration space, then one in the same physical gauge field, physically equivalent gauge field, intersect with this hypersurface many, many times. And even worse, there are points, so-called hypersurfaces, so-called Grieboff horizons, where the two equivalent gauge copies come infinitely close to each other. And therefore, the Fadier-Popov determinant is actually zero. So that means by playing this trick naively, you don't insert a 1 in the functional integral as is written in the book, but you insert a 0. And in gravity, I only found one paper that tells us that there is the same problem, same Grieboff type problem, but of course much, much less is known about the Grieboff problem in gravity. So one attempt at solving the problem is to constrain the integration over graviton fluctuation to the first Grieboff horizon, or the first Grieboff region, the inner part of the first Grieboff horizon containing the perturbative point. But now you know a couple of things. Well, this inner part of the region, this that region that the top of determinant, or the top of operator is non-negative, and at the boundary it becomes zero. In gauge theories, you can prove a number of things, namely that this is a convex region, and it is in a high-dimensional, infinite-dimensional region, and therefore most of the volume of this region sits right under the surface. Now, in gauge theory, at some coupling, since most of the volume sits right under the surface, those configurations which are close to the Grieboff horizon can dominate your fluctuations, in particular at some coupling. And since right at the horizon, the Fadier-Popov determinant goes to zero, the inverse of the Fadier-Popov operator, which is those populations that diverge can be enhanced. And therefore, those in certain cases can play a very important role in gauge theory, can even, in that picture of that specific gauge, dominate also physical correlations. So that's why we studied the dose sector. And what we particularly looked at was a dose curvature coupling term that we added to this list of operators that we tested. Now, from a power quantum viewpoint, this operator is marginal, because it's zero canonical dimension. But computing the flow tells you that at the fixed point, which is non-Gaussian fixed point in gravity, this particular coupling turns from marginal to relevant. So that might be the first signature that those couplings are actually important in this framework. So it's in essence practically free coupling. When you go from the ultraviolet to the infrared, it's an RT-relevant operator, so it's switched on very quickly. But it doesn't mean that it's an independent physical coupling, because it has to be subject to gauge theory. But as far as the fixed point is concerned, as this coupling is asymptotically free, it doesn't modify the fixed point. So the asymptotic safety scenario in gravity remains robust, even under the inclusion of dynamical stoke operators. Okay, so let me return to mechanisms. I told you gravity is one example for dimensional balancing. Let me give you another one. And again, I'd like to refer to the lecture notes 76, where Stephen Weinberg said, to see how this works, for instance, Young-Hill's theory, to see how this works in practice, safety, let's consider the theory in five dimensions, like the combination of the words in practice, five dimensions. But indeed, it's a very nice example. So that's another example where the fluctuation in these bonding is this negative sign, the first order fluctuation contribution, and the dimensional running is a positive sign, so the running can balance each other, and we get a moving fixed point, so it's driven by in the 80s. So this we get out of an epsilon expansion in V minus 4, expansion around the upper critical dimension. And of course, you're not interested in 4.01 dimensions, but you're interested in 5 dimensions, 6 dimensions, and so on. And if you look at the results for the beta function, the 0, 6 points, and high dimensions, you observe that 557 dimensions, the associated 6 point value is pretty large, of order 1, larger. So this epsilon expansion is certainly not reliable. Moreover, epsilon expansion is usually done with dimensional regularization techniques, and these are mass-independent RG schemes, whereas with gauge theories, four dimensions, you expect a mass gap, so you better work with a mass-dependent RG scheme to find out whether really Young-Hill theories in extra dimensions is asymptotically safe. So let me give you a simple example of why the naive picture that Young-Hill theories in extra dimensions is asymptotically safe for any dimension should break down. So let's start with four dimensions. There we know that Young-Hill theory has a mass gap. Now, if there is a mass gap, and that's the mass gap, and if you run the RG flow downwards, then at some point when your RG scale drops below the mass gap, there's simply no fluctuations left, so everything decouples, all the modes are happy. So you expect that there is an infrared fixed point in a certain RG scheme, which is mass-dependent, for a particular definition of the running coupling. So you expect a freeze-out of all couplings that are sensitive to the mass gap, and you expect infrared fixed points to occur. So that in some sense is a trivial fixed point just by decoupling of massive modes, right? So it's good that you buy the argument. So there's actually, depending on the gauge, depending on the actual definition of your fixed point, and depending on the RG scheme, there are evidences for this decoupling behavior. Started again with work by Martin Reuter, the professor, and the functional RG in the background gauge, and many other results. So you have this scenario for these particular definitions, ultraviolet asymptotic freedom, and then infrared fixed point. So So now let's generalize this scenario to higher dimensions. So assume that the fluctuation contribution is still analytic indeed, but then add the dimensional scaling. So the fluctuation contribution still looks like this, but the dimensional contribution, they will be positive for small g. So this induces the ultraviolet fixed point that you expect from the epsilon expansion. But at some critical dimension, this ultraviolet fixed point will annihilate with this infrared fixed point that you make in four dimensions. And above a certain critical dimension, you expect that there is no non-Gaussian fixed point anymore. There is no asymptotic safety. So that's the conjecture, and the question is, what is the critical? And for this, I've done a calculation with the functional RG in a truncation that includes infinitely many operators. It's like an F of R truncation of gravity. Here it's W of F squared in gauge theories. And for a different gauge group, SU2, SU3, SU5, you find indeed these pictures, and the critical dimension is always a bit larger than 5, or close to 5. So only between the messages, only between 4 and the critical dimension, around 5, there you have asymptotic freedom. Above that, asymptotic freedom is actually lost. And that's very different from higher dimensional studies of gravity, as our chairman showed, where you always find a non-Gaussian fixed point and no critical dimension. Asymptotic safety. The asymptotic safety is lost above the critical dimension. And there's a good reason that you should observe a critical dimension in Young-Mills theories and not in gravity, because in Young-Mills theories we know that there is this mass gap behavior in four dimensions, whereas we don't expect the mass gap in gravity. So that also is an example that not always when you start with a flow equation, use some truncation, you encounter a fixed point. The fixed point, the non-Gaussian one, is actually something very special. And they found the first order phase transition
in five dimensions. But first of all, these were very limited. I mean, five dimensions are very difficult. The other thing is that, I mean, you can expect that not just one particular coupling, one operator is a relevant operator, but perhaps two.
And then by doing lattice simulations, you would have to do fine-tuning in order to find the picture. So, yeah. And, or the other possibility is that, I mean, this is a calculation, a truncated scheme, perhaps the critical dimension is even below.
Close to five, then you do not know if it's a weak first order.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is the simulation and my results are really consistent within the error bar. Okay, let me come to the second mechanism, and it's of course closely related to the dimensional balancing. I'd like to call it conversion of degrees of freedom. And the example I'd like to mention has already been mentioned, which is a fermionic system, such as numbers from Alexandria or Gauss-Mazur, three dimensions. Also, as Bertrand Rivasseau said, that you can show that this coupling with one to dimension is one, and if you study the flow of the dimension coupling of the dimensional, of balancing, dimension contribution, fluctuation contribution, and again, using fixed points. And in this case, the fixed point distinguishes, like in the nonlinear signal model, between the metric phase, which we start with the reference fixed point, between one to the Gaussian one. So let's just see. Three-phase or three-phase, and if you start to the right of the fixed point, the system runs to infinite coupling, you find that the system shows parallelity behavior. And since there is a fixed point in two-dimensional theory, it's asymptotic, you see, safe even though it's conservatively non-denormalizable, you can show to all orders in the one-over-n expansion that this is actually denormalizable in this one-over-n expansion. Now you can do the same for d-dimensions. And the picture is basically the same. The dimensional running looks a little bit different, but you always get these parabolas in the fixed point. So is the system safe for all d? If it was so, that would be very nice. You could immediately start with models that look like the standard models, certain gauge symmetries, certain chiral symmetries. And then you would be able to write down many, many of these four fermion operators, as we did here a couple of years ago. much in the spirit of top-four condensation scenarios, even though we are looking at the ultraviolet. And then you get many of these parabolas for each of the running couplings, and that means you get two fixed points per parabola, and then they combine all, so you get 2^10 of the number of your couplings, fixed points, so that looks all very beautiful. Looks like as if you were able to write down many, many standard model universality classes that have different UV completion, but could look like a standard model in the infrared. So is it that simple? Of course, the answer is not yet. So let's look at this beta function a bit more carefully. So I plugged in a Fermi operator. I have the Gaussian fixed point, and I have the non-Gaussian fixed point, and there is a conversion of irrelevant to relevant. So at the Gaussian fixed point, this operator is irrelevant, because it is one smaller than zero. Whereas, it's a parabola, so the slope here is exactly the same as the slope here, but just with the other sign. So pretty respondent is positive, yep, sign, and is RG relevant. But now, since this is an RG relevant coupling, there can be, for instance, marginal subcomponents hidden in a non-local structure. So here I wrote down a non-local component in the S channel of this Fermi interaction. And, well, it looks pretty ugly, but by a Hubbard-Tonovich transformation, you can write this Fermi interaction, which is non-local coupling, which is the local one, in terms of an exchange of boson and the Yukawa interaction between the fermions. And from these couplings, you know that, for instance, in four dimensions, this is marginal, this is relevant. So you have this conversion of irrelevant to relevant mapped onto relevant and marginal interactions in the bosonic system. And this fact was exactly pointed out by Jean-Saint Justin, namely that you cannot only map on a quantum level the fermion system onto the Yukawa system, but you also have the same amount of physical parameters, which in the Yukawa language is a Yukawa mass and the Yukawa coupling. And in dimensions smaller than 4, this works very nicely for the non-Gaussian fixed point in the fermionic language, or the vicinity of the non-Gaussian fixed point is mapped to the vicinity of the Gaussian fixed point in the Yukawa theory. And here you know the theory is curvatively super renormalizable, whereas in the fermionic language it looks curvatively non-renormalizable. So you have this, in some sense, if you want to look at it optimistically, you have an explicit mapping of a strong coupling non-Gaussian fixed point to a weak coupling Gaussian fixed point. You have a duality. If you want to look at it pessimistically, you could say, well, it's asymptotic safety in the fermionic system is just, well, there's nothing but standard renormalizable theory in a large setting in the Yukawa framework. But the way how you look at it is just a question of N and A. But I would say it's a very nice example of a conversion of degrees of freedom where you have an explicit duality between different degrees of freedom describing the same physics. Now, if you go to four dimensions, then, of course, what looks like non-Gaussian fixed points in the fermionic theory can be destabilized by what happens in the Yukawa system. And there you know that in four dimensions, the possible fixed point structures can be destabilized by the triviality in the 5-4 sector and also in the Yukawa sector. And then it depends very much on the details, for instance, for the NJR case, which has been shown on the left, that this is really trivial. And this fixed point actually only states only an artifact of this local approximation. Okay, so if you want to apply an asymptotic safety scenario to standard model-like theories, the Higgs sector, for instance, in the standard model, it doesn't help if you just work with fermionic degrees of freedom. You really have to look at the full Yukawa system. And so that brings me to my third mechanism of asymptotic safety, which I would like to call the form of vacuum expectation value. So the first observation is that when you have something like a non-perturbative flow equation, there are two sources of non-perturbative mechanisms or not the purposive features. Of course, you can describe large coupling, but that's the trivial non purposes. But as we are talking about the exact propagator at a certain RG scale, to think about, for instance, a propagator in a potential that shows symmetry breaking that develops a vacuum excitation value, then your propagator has a mass which is proportional to the vet and the coupling to the vet. We have non-perturbative feature also in this microphone threshold behavior, in the behavior of how modes decouple from the flow once masses are generated. So the mechanism that I'd like to propose here relies on this threshold behavior. So usually, you would think a threshold behavior doesn't really help you for asymptotic safety, because asymptotic safety is something you want to have in the ultraviolet, whereas threshold behavior tells you that modes decouple in the infrared. So that's very different physics, and physics you wouldn't expect to be helpful for ultraviolet completion. And this is also seen here in the standard scenario for threshold behavior. So as long as you have no VEF, so you're here at zero at this axis, or if the VEF is much smaller than the RG scale that you're looking at, then your beta functions have a certain value. But as soon as your scale, your RG scale drops below the mass scale, and the fluctuations decouple, they are massive, and your beta functions usually decrease. So that's a typical threshold behavior for your system that runs down the threshold here, and you get decoupling of modes. That's a typical infrared behavior. But now imagine for a second that your vacuum expectation value isn't just a fixed number in physical units, but scales with your RG scale for some funny reason. Imagine that it shows a quasi-conformal behavior that runs with your RG scale. Then, because the RG scale cancels here, you could be sitting with your theory in this non-perturbative threshold region of your beta function. You simply stay there. It's like surfing on the back of a water wave in a streaming river. You have the impression that you always go down, but the water is coming up, actually. So you can stay in a steady state. And so this steady state can now be used for the infrared as well as the ultraviolet. I'd like to focus, of course, on the ultraviolet. So the question, of course, is how can I get a conformally evolving vacuum expectation value? Well, just look at the typical flow equation for the dimensionless vacuum expectation value. Of course, it starts with this dimensional term, minus 2 in this case, times the dimensionless depth. And then you get fermionic fluctuation contributions and bosonic contributions. And as usual, the fermions have a minus sign, whereas the bosons have a plus sign. So you see, you can have a balancing of fluctuation contribution. And so the typical beta function for the VEF looks like this. So dominantly, it has this, it is a straight line of slope minus 2. So if you don't have fluctuation contributions, the beta function for this dimension is VEF, which is often called kappa. This is a straight line of slope minus 2. Now, if the fermions dominate, you dominate with this minus sign, so the straight line moves to the left, and you get a non-Gaussian fit point, but at negative values of the VEF squared. So this is clearly unphysical, so you don't want to be sitting here. But if the bosons dominate, then this non-Gaussian fixed point moves to the right, moves to positive values, and that precisely corresponds to a conformal VEF running that I mentioned. So it's actually not unlikely, but it's a generic situation in Buchhaffer systems that you can have this balance in. So it's a little bit similar to supersymmetry, but in supersymmetric models, you arrange algebraically for a cancellation, whereas here, the system has the chance to arrange dynamically for a balancing between these two terms, depending on the coupling values. So you can get the conformal VEF, but you can even get more. Namely, if the beta function, for some reason, bends a little bit, depends further on this dimension of VEF, then you can get smaller slopes. smaller slopes mean smaller critical exponents, and smaller critical exponents mean best fine-tuning. Now, so you have the chance to improve, let's say, the UV behavior of a U-cover system, and at the same time, improve a little bit on the fine-tuning problem in these systems. Okay, so we started looking at a concrete example, a V2 invariant U-cover system. We have one Dirac fermion, one real scalar, and we computed this flow in the next leading order derivative expansion. That's just the technical detail, so let me just mention that there is a systematic expansion that you can work out order by order. We went to next to leading order. And so the first message is that in the symmetric regime, when there is no best, there is no non-Gaussian fixed point, so you get the standard triviality results in accordance with all the with all other methods. But when you go to the broken regime, in addition to the conformal F mechanism that I told you about, you get new effective couplings because the condensate mediates a further interaction, like here in this direction to the U-cover diagram. And so if you look at this equation of the running of the vacuum expectation value, you see that the negative contributions from the fermion scale with NF, with the number of fermions that you put into the system, and the bosons don't scale with NF because there's just one boson in the system. But we want to have the bosons dominate in order to get the conformal vest on the right hand side of the positive value. And the answer is you can get this vest, but only for fermion flavor numbers smaller than 0.3, smaller than the critical number, which is close to 0.3. So you need a fraction of a fermion to realize this conformal vest mechanism in this CP example. Doesn't look physical here at this point, certainly isn't physical, but let me just continue in order to show you a proof of principle that what type of consequences for also for infrared physics you could get out of such a conformal vest scenario, and I'll later show you a system where you can go to realistic fermion numbers. So let me just, for the sake of it, choose a tenth of a fermion here, and then you find this non-Gaussian fixed point. And what is most important here is that the anomalous dimensions of the boson and the fermion are smaller than one, so this is an effective expansion parameter. So the next to leading order derivative expansion is actually a controlled expansion here. And we find critical exponents, there's the complex quantity pairs of certain gravity, and the third exponent is already negative. That means you have two relevant directions in the game, so two physical parameters. But this is the first surprise, because if you study the U-cover system at the Gaussian fixed point, you have three physical parameters. You have, depending on how you formulate it, but you can write these three physical parameters as the vacuum expectation value, the top mass, and the Higgs mass. So at the non-Gaussian fixed point, you have only two physical parameters, because you have only two relevant directions. So once you fix the vacuum expectation value and the top mass, the Higgs mass is a prediction. So by means of this ultraviolet safe completion, you effectively can reduce the number of parameters. And there's actually no choice. So the theory just tells you that there are only two physical parameters. So we solve the flow here, so the flow of the cover coupling starts at the fixed point, we continue forever here at the fixed point. And there is a crossover region and an infrared vacuum expectation value freezes out and you get physical prediction. The same is true for the Higgs self-coupling. Well, as I said, once you fix the vacuum expectation value, say, to the physical value 246 dV, and fix the top mass, which is a pretty unphysical value, then you have no option. The Higgs mass is a prediction. You cannot fiddle around with it in this particular theory of 644 dV. So also we find a mechanism you cannot actually choose arbitrary top quark values, and they are actually dynamically bounded from below. So these systems actually offer a type of dynamical explanation why the top mass has to be heavy. And if you ask, what about the fine-tuning problem? Remember, in the standard model, the maximum critical exponent was 2. Here, in this, for this particular scenario, it's 1.6. So the fine-tuning problem is a little bit less severe. But of course, there is still a fine-tuning problem in these models. But as I said, one-tenth of a fermion is not very attractive. So we were looking for an algebraic content of our Yukawa system that allows us to go to realistic fermion numbers. And it turned out that actually the left-right asymmetric structure, the chiral structure that we know from the standard model, is exactly of the type that allows us to go to realistic fermion numbers. So here we studied one right-handed fermion and NL left-handed fermion coupled to Yukawa particles that also carry the fermion number index in a chiral metric fashion. And now if you crank up the left-handed fermion number, what actually happens is that you crank up the influence of the bosons, because there are more and more boson species running around here, whereas in the fermion loop, always the one right-handed fermion run around. So there is no NL scaling here. So we find 6 points for realistic fermion numbers here. So these are the critical exponents depending on the number of fermions, the left-handed numbers. And what is most surprising here is that there is only one relevant direction, only one positive for the exponent. There are actually 2 6 points. One is actually more effective. If the order is one, the others are negative. So the message is there is only one relevant direction. There's only one physical parameter. Once you fix the vacuum expectation value, the top mark and the Higgs mark, it's a prediction. So the basic message is that once you insist on ultraviolet completion by means of asymptotic safety, that's not just a metaphysical issue of finding a complete theory, but it also fixes you a lot of infrared physics, because you have to live with the number of relevant directions that the 6 point has. There is no way to return or to modify the number of physical parameters. And that's what just comes out for the prediction for in this particular scenario for the 10 left in this version. These are very top art. So unfortunately, it has to be taken with a grain of salt, because when you get higher orders in this expansion, in this particular model, there are massive Goldstone bosons, there are massive fermion modes, and so on. So they can destabilize the 6 points. But this is a problem that is not present in the full standard model, where you don't have Goldstone bosons, but this is taken care of by the gauge version. Okay, so this brings me to my conclusions. I hope I've convinced you that there are actually several mechanisms to get an asymptotic safe system. The conventional dimensional balancing that we know from many systems, then also the conversion of degrees of freedom, and this new mechanism that I presented, and that will be discussed in more detail by the talk of Michael Scherer on Saturday afternoon, the conformal vector mechanism. And what I find very inspiring is that you cannot only solve by construction triviality problems, but you have also a handle on fine-tuning problems in systems like the Higgs vector of the standard model. And what is perhaps most important, that you also are bound as far as the number of physical parameters are concerned. So this is a prediction of the system. And all these positive features arise all within quantum Q theory. And as far as this inspiring question of space-time dimensionality is concerned, at least it asymptotic safety provides you with a different perspective on whether space-times can become large, whether interactions of metafields are supported or not. So it's a question we may talk about over a glass of wine tonight. Thank you.
For this nice presentation. Are there questions?
Please. But even if you take the NGI model in four dimensions and you consider the infrared filtering, you have also that the ratio of the scalar mass to the Fermion mass is fixed. Even there, it's a prediction.
Not quite, as you showed in your nice paper, because there. Values are in the renormalization scheme. There is a further parameter hidden, which basically decouples in the Yukawa language, the Yukawa coupling from the mass parameter. So if you insist on a fixed ratio, which you can also express as a compositeness condition, that the wave function of the bosons wage function renormalization is equal to zero at a certain scale, then you have a fixed relation that you're referring to. But in the larger framework of your Yukawa theories, you don't get really a reduction of parameters. And the one that I'm talking about, that's a very different reduction of parameters.
I understand.
Yes. All of your parameters, I mean, all of your examples, I mean, your top forecast is for. Could you not do any better than the Was that so the best that you could?
No, I mean,
he's showing his honesty.
but it's, I mean, it's good because I'm not talking about SU3 plus SU2 plus U1 and the right Fermi content, but I'm talking about toy models. So why should the toy model top quark mass be the physical one?
Yeah, but no, why didn't you do the real theory?
Yeah. First you walk, then you run. Okay. So let's start first with simple systems. But it's a good point. I mean, the scenario I'm suggesting has a very important advantage. It's falsifiable. Yeah? I just compute the top quark mass and I have no options. And either it comes out correctly or my theory is falsified. Isn't that good? I mean, it's more than you can expect from many other frameworks.
It's not only falsifiable, it's falsified.
If I had done the calculation.
This theory is falsified.
Yeah, sure.
My prediction is not falsified yet, because the minimum value of the ratio is 1.2. So, and it seems to be already endangered, but it would give a 200 GB, something like that, for the X part, which is less and less likely. 1.2 times the top.
It actually depends a lot on the support mass, which changes these things a little bit.
A very small mass is a little bit is somewhat favorable to supersonic.
So it's likely that it is in this channel here, so that's kind of more valid. It's kind of disaster.
Any further questions?
Well, if not, then let's finish. And I suggest that we reconvene something like 5 past 12.